Good afternoon. It's 12:06 and time for Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. I'm Sarah D'Elia, hoping that you'll join today's conversation by giving us a call at 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Midday Matters Facebook page or email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm. In the studio, we're joined by my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman.
Thank you, Sarah. Today we'll be discussing human papillomavirus and sexually transmitted infections, cancer associations, and vaccine prevention. Up to 79 million Americans are currently infected with the human papillomavirus. Of the more than 100 strains, most are low risk, causing warts, common warts on the skin surfaces, the face, hands, and feet. But 40 strains can cause sexually transmitted infections of the genital areas of males and females, with up to 20 million new sexually transmitted infections in the United States per year. The majority of these infections are low risk. They clear spontaneously over 1 to 2 years, with most infected individuals never being aware that they have become infected. However, several of these sexually transmitted strains of HPV are high risk and can persist over many years and eventually cause cancer to develop in the anogenital and oral areas. Interestingly, there is no way to predict which of these infections are going to progress to more severe disease and cancer, and the cancer may come on 10 to 20 years after the initial infection. While HPV, the virus itself, cannot be cured, the symptoms can be treated, and most importantly, the cancers caused by these agents can be prevented by vaccinating our young people before they become sexually active. Here to discuss the personal and public health issue of human papillomavirus infection and its related cancers is Dr. Deborah McMahon, the Allen County Health Commissioner and a board-certified internist. Welcome, Dr. McMahon. What are the different types of HPV infections, and who gets the HPV infections in our society, and how is it transmitted?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to know that HPV virus is very easily transmitted from person to person. It's a very contagious virus. Just skin-to-skin contact is all that's required. And it's usually, that's how it's usually transmitted, is through the skin-to-skin contact. And the different types of diseases we see are the various cancers that you've talked about. I think most people are familiar with cervical cancer. What people may not realize is that the strains that cause cervical cancer have also been implicated in vulvar cancer, penile cancer, anal cancer, and head and neck cancer. So cancers are really, I think, one of the most important things or most significant health issues that are related to the virus. But we also have the nuisance, but can be quite traumatic for folks who have them, are the genital warts. And we know that there are a couple strains, 6 and 11, that cause 90% of the genital warts that we see. So again, that's more traumatic, but certainly doesn't have, at least that we know of now, doesn't have the long-term significance that the strains that cause cancer do.
And the genital warts are the apparent signs of HPV infection, but they are not usually associated with cancer development. But the strains that cause cancer development usually don't cause any obvious symptoms until cancer develops many years later. What are the risk factors making one more susceptible to HPV infection?
Well, I think anything that puts you obviously in contact with the virus. So I think folks that have multiple sexual partners. But I think when you say that, I think it's so important to remember that one infected sexual partner can acquire the disease from that one partner. So sexual partners, I think, you know, early onset of sexual activity, all those sorts of things that, again, put you in contact with someone who has the virus. But I think it's important to remember that many people can have this virus on board and not have any symptoms. There's no real screening test for it, so it's not like you can go and get checked up periodically to see if you have acquired this virus. We know that the numbers you talked about, 20 million cases a year, but the CDC also estimates that 1 in 2 sexually active people are infected with this virus, and they may or may not have anything observable like a wart.
I want to mention that we will be having Dr. Francis Escara from the Women's Health Advantage joining the program a little bit later by phone. He's in surgery right now, but hopefully will be able to call us and lend a perspective of what you can expect when going into a doctor's office and what you need to know, how often you should be going to the doctor to get yourself checked out. If you have a question or comment, 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio with my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, as well as the Allen County Health Commissioner, Dr. Deborah McMahon. And I wanted to ask before we get too far away from it, how are we doing in Northeast Indiana with HPV? Have we noticed an increase on people being diagnosed with the virus? Is there any kind of sense or data as to if those numbers are increasing?
Well, first of all, it's not a reportable disease, so I don't have any accurate report of any the number of cases that we're actually seeing. But I do think that we see a fair amount of cases at our medical annex where we treat those kinds of infections, and I hear from other providers that they're also seeing it. So I have no reason to believe we're doing any better than the national average of 1 and 2. So I think it's a very, very common virus.
Dr. McMahon, what can individuals do to prevent these infections? And what can women do over the long term to at least be monitored for the development of cervical cancer?
Well, I think number one, most importantly, and for us in public health, we believe very strongly in vaccines. We think they're a very important tool in preventing disease, especially when you have something that can have such what we would call a long latent period, where between infection and the development of cancer can be a very long period of time. We don't really have a lot of screening tools for HPV virus. So in those kinds of situations, and we know, again, it's so common, 1 and 2, and again, very easily transmitted, those are the kinds of infections that we really do like to prevent with a vaccine. And so there are two vaccines directed towards the HPV virus that are used and have been approved by the FDA in the United States. They're for girls and boys, starting at age 11 or 12. The reason it's so early, and a lot of people think, well, of course a child wouldn't be sexually active. Why do they need to be vaccinated so young? Well, number one, we know that the earlier that we vaccinate folks, the more robust their immune response is going to be, and so therefore, higher levels of protection. So that's really, I think, the main reason. You want to do it before there's any risk of exposure, but even more importantly, at a time in their life when they're really going to have a very good response and manufacture a lot of those protective antibodies. So we start providing that vaccine at age 11 or 12.
We have a caller online, one along those lines, asking a question about the vaccine. Tony, welcome to Health 360.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. My question and comment is, just from being in the community, I've noticed a lot of opposition to the HPV vaccine simply because people are worried about people being looser with their, you know, sexuality, which I disagree with, but that's just what I seem to notice. And do you see a resistance because of that kind of thinking? And secondly, how important it is for young males to also get vaccinated, and even if they're not sexually active and in their later teens, is that still a good time to get them vaccinated?
Well, the answer to your second question is yes, young men, it's really important to prevent HPV virus or infection with them as well. About 7,000 cancers a year occur in the male population in men that are related to the HPV vaccine. So again, that's really something that we'd like to prevent by this vaccination process. And the recommendations, as long as they start the series before they're 26 or before they turn 27, you know, they're certainly a good candidate for vaccination. And again, for the same reason we spoke earlier, the earlier the better, because again, the more robust response they're going to have and the more protection they're going to have in terms of the development of those antibodies. So of course, we'd like them to get at 11 or 12, get the vaccination as recommended for the girls as well. But at any age, like I said, before age 26 is fine. We do see a lot of resistance. I remember when they were trying to make that one of the mandatory vaccines for the school, there was a lot of public resistance about this vaccination. And I think it is unfortunate because I don't think there have been any studies. In fact, I think they have looked specifically at the question, does that really drive folks to earlier sexual activity? And it's a resounding no. This vaccine doesn't encourage in any way children to become more, young people to become more sexually active. But I do think it's important to look again also at the numbers, and we do see a lot of sexual activity occurring in our high school folks. And we know that middle school kids around the nation, and again, I think it'd be a luxury to think that we're exempt from that same phenomena, but we see a lot of oral sex in middle school kids. And again, this is really important then to make sure that we have talked and counseled our kids about sexual activity and what it means and what all sexual activity includes, but then also to provide those protections for them through vaccination and other sorts of things, screenings.
And I would agree with Dr. McMahon. First of all, they really have shown a much better immune response to the vaccine in the younger ages. Mm-hmm. And two, one half of the new cases of HPV in our society are between the ages of 15 and 24. The question of immunizing boys and men, very important in that we're having a significant increase in oropharyngeal cancer of the tonsils, throat, and this is found mainly in men and in heterosexual men, and this is accounting for more than 50% of oral cancers in men, which used to be just ascribed to alcohol and tobacco. So, and men can carry the infection without having any symptoms.
Exactly. And I don't think it's any coincidence that we're seeing those new infections in that age group, because that's still the same age group that we see all of the sexually transmitted infections, chlamydia, gonorrhea, all of those sorts of things we see in those younger populations. It's also been recommended, and I think it's important to note, that this vaccine is also recommended for what we call the population MSM, or men who sleep with men, homosexual or gay men, because I think there's higher rates of anal cancer, again, due to HPV. So again, we want to provide that protection by making sure that folks are vaccinated.
260-452-1185 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. We're devoting the whole hour of Health 360 today to a discussion on the HPV virus and what you need to know about the vaccine, some of the symptoms as well, and the treatment options available. Again, that number, 260-452-1185. You can always email us anonymously or not anonymously, middaymatters@nipr.fm, or post questions and comments on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be back with more of Health 360 here on WBOY in just a few moments.
In 1996, more than 4 out of 5 members of Congress voted in favor of the Defense of Marriage Act. Since then, public opinion's shifted. 9 states and D.C. allow same-sex marriage. Now the Supreme Court hears arguments about equal treatment. I'm Neil Cunnan. We'll listen in on the arguments over DOMA with David Savage of the Los Angeles Times. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News this afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
WBOI needs your help during our spring fun drive, April 20th through the 28th. Answer phones, meet and talk with the WBOI staff and other public radio listeners. Weekday and weekend volunteer opportunities in the morning, afternoon, and evening are available. Register online at nipr.fm or call 452-1189. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by PHP, offering a variety of health benefits and services for individuals, families, and businesses in Northern Indiana, including medical, dental, high deductible, administrative services, and more at phpni.com.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Reinbold and Anderson, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Are your investments tax-wise? More information at Reinbold and Anderson on the web at reinboldandanderson.com.
You're listening to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. The time is 12:21. If you have any questions or comments, we're devoting this whole hour to the HPV virus. Treatment causes symptoms. 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email, middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio by my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, as well as Dr. Deborah McMahon. She's the Allen County Health Commissioner. And Dr. McMahon, we were talking a little bit about before the break, the age range that it's recommended that folks get vaccinated, which is like 11 to 26.
9 to 26.
9 to 26. Mm-hmm. Okay. Why the 26 cutoff? Folks that are older and maybe less sexually active, I mean, are they still eligible to get the vaccine?
Actually, no. It's FDA approved for that age population, 9 to 26. And studies have really shown that it's not as effective in that older population, again, for the reasons we've talked about, the robustness of the immune system the younger you are. But also, I think the likelihood of being exposed already to that virus is significantly higher in the populations older than the age 26. So for right now, that is the cutoff.
Many people feel that condoms can prevent HPV infection. Is this really true?
Well, I think that's a difficult issue for public health as well as for the patients, because we're so used to being the mantras that condoms. But the problem when you have those diseases that are spread by just plain skin-to-skin contact, condoms are effective in the areas that are covered, but if the virus is in areas that are not covered by a condom, then you can still have the transmission. So they're not foolproof. And I think that's another reason why, again, I feel like I have an opportunity to talk to younger people because of the position I have and the methods by which I'm talking with kids and interacting with young people in our clinics. And I really think conversation with parents and their young adolescence is really important, because I think just from my conversations in with not only the young folks, but then with parents and other folks in the community, I think there's a disconnect between the two populations on what's actually happening and what kids are actually encountering and the pressures that they're feeling to be sexually active. For example, as I mentioned, in middle school, oral sex there's pressure for young kids to have oral sex in middle school. There is a belief by a number of young folks that if they have anal sex and not vaginal sex, that they're not having sex. Again, these are things that parents need to know about, because they need to talk to their kids about these sorts of things, because we're seeing the incidence of anal sex increase, or anal cancers increase, and they're also carried by those same HPV-16. So again, kids are really misinformed by what they think is really sexual activity and then the associated risks with those activities. And parents can be a really good source of information and share that with their kids, as well as talking to them about the pressures they feel to be sexually active and the messaging that they're getting about their sexuality and how best to handle that as a young person. So again, we don't have the vaccine is not 100% protective. You know, it's going to protect 70% of the, it's going to, you know, prevent 70% of the cervical cancers, but it's not 100%. Condoms, not 100%. There's no replacement for really having good conversation with your kids and really knowing what they're doing and them feeling comfortable to come to you and talk about issues that they're feeling pressured with.
While the rates of cancer in our society have been going down in recent years, there has definitely been an increase in oropharyngeal cancer caused by the HPV, again by the HPV-16 subclass, which is covered, by the way, by the vaccines. And this is related to oral sex. And studies have shown that up to 50% of sexually active teenagers and almost 95%+ of sexually active adults have oral sex at some point in their lives. So this is a real issue, and the highest incidence of oral cancers caused by HPV are in heterosexual men, not just homosexual men. So this is an issue that we have to really address.
And, you know, the concern other than the vaccine is I'm not really sure how we really talk, and, you know, I guess dental dams and those sorts of things ought to have safe sexual practices with the different types of sexual activity people are having now. What was interesting with, there was a study, I think it was done in England, where they looked at the prevalence and the incidence of head and neck cancer in men, and it only, the average number of oral sexual activities was 6. So it's not like, you know, hundreds of times are required for you to acquire the virus to have that transformation to then turn into cancer. You know, 6 times over a lifetime, these were older men, is not necessarily a large number. So again, we're in a new territory now. We're in a new era of sexual activity and how best to prevent ourselves. And I think we need to have a lot of tools in the tool belt. We need to have a lot of bullets in our gun to be able to effectively prevent some of these preventable cancers that we may be faced with as we get older.
The initial recommendations by the federal government and the CDC were to immunize young girls, mm-hmm. Age 11 and 12, going into middle school with the HPV vaccine. But it became apparent that boys, obviously, and men can transmit the disease too. So by 2011, the recommendation was for young boys as well. But currently in our society, we have very few boys being immunized and not enough young ladies. And last week, Australia announced that they were mandating HPV vaccine for all boys in Australia. And where are we at when it comes to the immunization rates of our children and teenagers, and how can we improve this?
You know, it's very disappointing when you look at not only the percentage of people, it's less than 50% at any time, who are vaccinating their children for these particular infections. What's really disappointing to me is the rate of completion. You know, in 2006, I think is when the vaccine first became available, the completion rate of the series was well over 50%, which for a 3-dose series of vaccines that aren't mandated, that was actually fairly good. You certainly want it to be better. But now it's down to like 20% of the people are actually completing the series. This vaccine is effective when you receive the series of 3 shots at time 0, 1 month later, and then within 6 months. And the number of people completing is really less than 1 in 4. And, you know, I just think, you know, we're leaving a lot of protection on the table, if you will, by not completing that series. Now, one of the things other than mandating, which really met a lot of resistance when that was recommended or suggested a few years ago for Indiana. But one of the things that we can really do is really try and make sure that they're ready access to these vaccines, because they are expensive. It's probably about, if you had to just go out and purchase one, it'd be about $130 to complete the series, probably right around $400 or $500. So I get that. But you know, we're coming into a time with the Affordable Care Act that health insurance companies need to be able to provide vaccines for folks free of charge. They should be at no cost to the patient. I would hope that we're going to see an uptick in patients who are not only vaccinating their children, but completing that series. But I think there is such a, for some reason, a stigma about this vaccine, as though, again, it's going to lead to a certain type of promiscuous behavior, that I think that really impedes the vaccination rates in not just our community, but I think, you know, in nationally, compared to a place like Australia or Europe, you know, countries in Europe where they have much higher vaccination rates. They're taking advantage of this vaccine.
And England has an 80% rate in young girls, and Australia has 75% rate. It has been stated that the federal government does have a vaccination aid program where mm-hmm. they will help underprivileged families or people that are below the poverty line pay for these vaccines. And I believe the drug companies involved also
patient
have
assistance
programs.
Mm-hmm.
This is true?
The Vaccine for Children Fund is has all the recommended and required vaccines for children available to uninsured, Medicaid, or underinsured children. So those vaccines are available. There are different VFC providers, the Vaccines for Children VFC providers. We're one at the health department, but some doctor's offices are also VFC providers where you can get your child vaccine. So I'm not sure that access is necessarily the biggest barrier for folks, because those are available. For folks who are insured, but maybe they have a high deductible, or maybe their insurance company doesn't at this point cover vaccines, you're right, the patient assistance programs make those readily available. So again, I'm not sure. I'm hopeful that when we see vaccine restrictions from insurance companies and when they're readily more readily available, that maybe we'll see that number tick up. But I really think this sort of bias or stigma is really more of an issue.
We have to take a quick break for the news in just a couple of minutes here on Health 360. But before we do that, I wanted to just see, Dr. McMahon, is there anybody that should not be looking to get the vaccine? I mean, it sounds like from all the research that we've shared today that it's a very safe vaccine. But is there anybody that a doctor would look at because of their medical history or allergies and say, no, you're not a prime candidate?
I think it would be a very unusual person who would have a contraindication to this vaccine. It's not a live virus, so we don't have to worry about immune status or anything like that. The side effects are fairly nominal, and what you see in other, and we can talk more about that after the break, because I know there's been a lot of question about the safety of this vaccine, but it's a safe vaccine. So, you know, you always want to talk to your provider about whether you are a good candidate for any vaccine, including HPV, but most people are good candidates to get this vaccine.
It is not recommended for pregnant women only because it hasn't been studied in pregnant women.
Right.
We're going to take a quick break for the news here on Health 360, but we'll be back. In the meantime, if you have any questions or comments, 260-452-1185. You can email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Sean Beter with WBOI News. Indiana students participating in the state's voucher program can continue to attend private schools using taxpayer dollars after the state Supreme Court Tuesday deemed the system constitutional. As State Impact Indiana's Ellie Moxley reports, opponents of school vouchers had hoped to sway the state's high court with arguments that the two-year-old program hurts public schools.
Nearly all of the Indiana private schools that accept vouchers have a religious affiliation, but Indiana State Teachers Association Vice President Teresa Meredith and others challenging the voucher law say the state shouldn't be in the business of funding religious schools.
I know we live in a very conservative state, but still, I thought that the Supreme Court would potentially rule in supportive of the many, many children who attend public schools every day.
Meredith says money to pay for the voucher program comes off the top of what the state allocates for public schools, but the Indiana Supreme Court says it's the parents who choose which school their children will go to, not the state. Friedman Foundation President Robert Inlow says Tuesday's decision settles the question of school voucher constitutionality in Indiana.
Hopefully this will start to have our policymakers and our public start to think about how we redefine education to stop talking about school type and start focusing on how we fund kids and how we get quality.
Even before Tuesday's ruling, state lawmakers were already considering expanding the two-year-old voucher program to make more students eligible. For State Impact Indiana, I'm Ellie Moxley.
An Indiana House committee is set to consider a proposal that would require clinics offering the abortion pill to perform ultrasounds on women seeking the drugs. The proposal approved by the state Senate last month would also force clinics that provide only drug-induced abortions to meet the same facility requirements as clinics that perform surgical abortions. Planned Parenthood says that could force it to stop providing the abortion pill at its Lafayette clinic. The House Public Policy Committee is holding a hearing on the bill Wednesday and could then vote on whether to advance it to the full House. The bill does not specify what type of ultrasound must be done, but abortion rights supporters say it would essentially force women seeking the abortion pill to undergo a transvaginal ultrasound. The Indiana Public Defenders Council says legislation overhauling the state's criminal code toughens sentences for some crimes without providing evidence. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, the council says the bill's sentencing structure needs to be addressed this session.
A legislative commission spent years crafting the criminal code revision bill, but the commission's final product didn't include a new sentencing grid, which would outline the number of years assigned to each felony level, including increasing the penalties for serious crimes. Public Defenders Council Executive Director Larry Landis points out the maximum amount of time served for a rape conviction could increase by more than 27 years under the proposed bill. Landis says there's no evidence to suggest increasing the penalty will help prevent the crime, and says the sentences actually need to be lowered in this year's bill.
Of the 150 legislators, I can't probably identify more than six who are likely to vote next year to reduce the sentences, even if they agree they're too high.
If it's passed, the bill wouldn't go into effect until 2014, so the legislature can address issues with it next session. And Bedford Republican Senator Brent Steele says if the General Assembly needs to reduce the sentences next year, it will.
People already have voted in the House to reduce some of the penalties in this bill. So to say that there's never the courage on the part of any legislator to take a hard vote, I don't think that's true.
A Senate committee will vote on the bill Thursday. If passed, the measure will head to the Senate Appropriations Committee. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
You're listening to Midday Matters Health 360 with your hosts Sarah D'Elia and Dr. Peter Rothman.
Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOI. The time is 12:37. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 260-452-1185. Email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post right on our Facebook page, It's Midday Matters. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio this afternoon with my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, as well as the Allen County Health Commissioner, Dr. Deborah McMahon. And we're devoting this whole hour of Midday Matters today to the HPV virus, symptoms, causes, and treatment. And Dr. McMahon, before the break, we were talking a little bit about some of the side effects of the vaccine. And I was hoping we could elaborate a little bit more on what some of those side effects are if you're somebody that is thinking about getting the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of people might be surprised at what an extensive infrastructure we have in the United States really looking at adverse events from medications and vaccines. We have the VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is a way of collecting data so that if a patient or a physician vaccinates a person with HPV vaccine and anything happens, they get a rash, all of a sudden, you know, they get a headache or anything, you don't try and sort out, gee, was this related to the vaccine or not? You report it to this system. This system is then mined through the CDC and the FDA and other groups that really look at that to look for trends or try and spot different types of adverse events that may not have been noted when they did their initial testing with a smaller group of people. Now you're doing millions of people. I think, what, 40 million people have been vaccinated
46
now.
46 million already.
46 million people. Now you have a lot of data that you can look for to see if there are anything that happens. There are also two other big databases where data is put in where adverse events are really attempted to be determined, again, after production and after they've been administered to large groups of people. The most common things, though, that we see with the HPV vaccine is syncope or fainting, and we see that also with the meningococcal, and we think it's more a function of that age group, the early adolescent, than anything with the vaccine. But that is something that we see. So it's recommended that after they're vaccinated with HPV that they lay down for 15 minutes or so. But then you can see the other things that you see, a little redness or soreness at the spot where you're vaccinated, some nausea or headache, those sorts of things. Very transient, very self-limited types of reactions. There have been a number of deaths, I think 32 deaths reported that were thought, that again, were reported through this VAERS system. Mm-hmm. When they went back to look at all of those deaths, there was no trend to think that it was related to the vaccine. So again, they don't believe there have been. There was a time when they had noticed with one of the vaccines that there was an increase in blood clots. They went back and looked at those, and for 90% of those cases, they found an underlying risk factor that put them at risk for the blood clots. And then there were a couple cases of some ALS, neurologic disease, and they could not find any reason why the vaccine might have been related to that, but they're continuing to study that on a long-term basis. So I feel very comfortable that it's a safe vaccine. People can have adverse side effects that aren't listed on the little pamphlet you get. I mean, that can always happen. But I think the data is being very closely monitored, and I feel comfortable that they're doing everything they can to make sure that if there is an adverse side effect that we aren't aware of, that we become aware of it and can let people know.
We had a listener write in with a question wanting to know a little bit more about some of the myths of the virus. Is this is HPV a virus that can be caught from a toilet seat? Is it something that a virus that stays live outside of the body for a long time? And what's the connection between HPV and genital warts?
Well, most viruses aren't able to live outside the body very long. It's for hours, if anything. But it's important to remember, especially with those strains of HPV that we're talking about causing genital warts and those types of cancer, it really does require skin to skin, mucous membrane to mucous membrane. That's how that virus is transmitted. But again, very easily transmitted that way. So you're safe on the toilet seat. Don't have to worry about that.
And what about anogenital warts? These are caused by certain strains of the HPV virus that mm-hmm. usually don't progress to cancer, but can be obviously disfiguring and a problem. What do we know about the warts?
Very, very traumatic. 6 and 11 are the strains of HPV that cause most of the 90% of the genital warts. And one important thing for a lot of people, because there's a lot of embarrassment, you don't have to have had anal sex to have anal warts. And that's a real point of embarrassment for a lot of people. And it keeps them from coming in. Genital warts, again, they don't have the long-term implications for cancer or you know, other more serious or life-threatening conditions. But they are so traumatizing for folks because they can be very small, they can be very large, you can have a few, you can have, you know, almost 100 of them, a carpet, if you will, of warts. So it can be very traumatic for people that have them. And again, they can be treated, but it can be, depending on the size and the number of them, it can be a fairly long-term process. One thing we do know is that the virus can go away, as you said, but sometimes it can re-express itself, you know, a month later after you've cleared your warts. It may be a year later, 5 years later. We do know that smoking increases that risk of them recurring, of the warts recurring. So I'm sure it's having some impact on the virus that something with sustainability or something. I don't think we know yet, but we know that that's a risk factor for recurrence.
And it's been mentioned that up to 350,000 Americans have these anogenital warts at any given point. And the good news is that, again, with the quadrivalent, the vaccine that takes care of the four major strains, the quadrivalent vaccine will prevent the anogenital
warts. Prevent 90% of those. And
right.
People can wait a long period of time before they come in because they're so embarrassed by these. Sometimes we'll see people will have had these for like a year. Just someone the other day that had these actually for a year and was so embarrassed that they didn't want to tell their doctor about it. So they finally came to us and, you know, thankfully we'll be able to treat them. A lot of different types of treatments, some topical cryotherapy. There are some medications that kind of work from the inside out, Eldera, those kinds of things. So there's a lot of different treatment options. We can always make them go away, but again, it's better not to have them in the first place.
260-452-1185 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. We just have about 15 minutes left in today's program. We're joined by Allen County Health Commissioner Dr. Deborah McMahon and, of course, my co-host Dr. Peter Rothman to help answer your questions about HPV. You can always write in at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. I wanted to shift the last 15 minutes or so of our conversation more towards the importance of pap smears and the routine checkups that women should be making sure that they do for their bodies to hopefully catch things like HPV or cervical cancer cells to prevent them from progressing. So what do you recommend for women as far as pap smears go and any other additional testing?
Well, I think from my perspective, I think it's really important to remember that a pap smear is part of the exam that your doctor is going to do. And we now know that they recommend that those start actually at age 21, I believe, where we start doing the actual pap smears. But I think it's never too early to go in and talk with your doctor when you're sexually active about your risks of having and acquiring certain sexually transmitted infections, because remember, you can have them and not be symptomatic at all. And again, you can be giving those to other folks or increasing your risk of developing long-term issues. So again, you still need to see your physician every year. You need to be tested, I think, for sexually transmitted infections. I think a pap smear is looking specifically at the cervix and looking for precursors to cervical cancer, or frankly, cervical cancer if you've waited too long. But that's part of an exam called the pelvic exam, where the doctor will do a visual inspection. Again, they're looking for cysts, warts, those sorts of things. They'll do what's called the bimanual exam, where they're going to feel your uterus, maybe see if you have any fibroids. They'll feel your ovaries, make sure there are no cysts or tumors or anything in there. They'll feel the lining between your rectum and your vagina to make sure that there's nothing there that should not be there. So again, I think it's important to remember that when we say pap smear should start at 21, that it's important to remember that that's just part of an exam, and you need to see your physician every year when you're sexually active to make sure that you stay healthy.
And the important thing to remember, too, is that there is no blood test for the human papillomavirus. This virus only is in epithelial cells in the skin or in the mucous membrane. So, but with the pap smear itself, if they find dysplastic or cells that are changing, they will then take those cells into a cytological exam looking for the DNA of the human papillomavirus and can then identify whether that really is an HPV infection causing precancerous or cancerous change. So it really is the only screening test we have at this time.
And it's so frustrating because people oftentimes will present to us because they've had a number of sexual partners and they just want to be screened for everything. Well, everything can't be screened for. I mean, some things you just have to prevent from actually happening in the first place when you have that opportunity. Because you're right, that's the only type of HPV screening we have is looking at cervical epithelium. And so again, that makes it very dangerous when you can't tell when you have something. And another thing that I just wanted to address is typically when we think of cancer, especially cervical cancer, anal cancer, we're thinking of older folks when they have that. Well, we just had a 30-year-old young woman with stage 3 cervical cancer. So again, you really need to be on top of your game here. You need to, you know, be talking with your doctor, being examined, getting the appropriate tests that they recommend, understanding that sometimes these recommendations and guidelines change over time. It's always, based on best practice and evidence, but sometimes the recommendations do change. And that's why it's important to keep in touch with your doctor once a year to go in for that checkup.
And while cervical cancer rates have gone down because the great majority of American women do get their pap smears, as we mentioned earlier, the incidence of oropharyngeal cancer is increasing. There have been some recent studies at Ohio State University where they're actually looking for the human papillomavirus DNA in oral washings. Mm-hmm. And this is not necessarily an approved technique, but there are efforts being made to try to make the diagnosis in other tissues besides the cervix.
Right. Well, vulvar cancer, penile cancer, anal cancer, all of these types of cancers are increasing, and most of them are caused by the human papillomavirus. So it's important to remember, too, I think that always a reminder that viruses are a little different than bacteria. Bacteria can coexist with your cells. Viruses take over your cells. They take over your skin cells, your epithelial cells, and they use your DNA machinery to make more copies of themselves. So they're a little more sinister, a little more difficult to find. They're more difficult to treat because they're actually part of you now. They're not something that you can just target like a bacteria, because they're inside your cells now. So, you know, again, that's why I think anything with a virus that we are able to develop a vaccine for, I wish we had one for hepatitis C, any type of virus that we can develop a vaccine for, take advantage of it. Take advantage.
260-452-1185 is the number to call before the break that we're going to take in just a few moments here on Health 360. The show's is only 10 minutes more or longer. So if you have a question or a comment, make sure you do give us a call at 260-452-1185. And you can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm. Before we do get to that break, though, Dr. McMahon, I was thinking while you were talking about the importance of pap smears and pelvic exams. I mean, it seems, unfortunately, that that does fall so much to the female population, because there, to my knowledge, there is no test for men to make sure that they're not carriers. So that does seem to rely more on women to make sure that they are getting themselves checked out.
That's right. And men for other infections where they can be also asymptomatic but still be a carrier, like with gonorrhea. Most men will be symptomatic, but chlamydia, men can be carrying this and infect other folks and not be aware of it. I think it's also important to mention for the HPV, for the anal cancer, now we do the anal pap smear. I think some people have never, might not have heard of that, but for those high-risk folks, we can do the same kind of cytologic testing to make sure that if people are progressing to that, that we're going to be able to treat that early as well.
And as Dr. McMahon pointed out, the HPV virus, the DNA of this virus, takes over these epithelial cells, but the vaccine itself does not contain any HPV DNA, and it cannot cause HPV infection. Okay. It is made from a surface antigen of the virus, so it really is not a live virus vaccine and cannot cause an infection.
We're going to leave it there for just a few moments. When we take a break, we'll be back with more of our HPV discussion going on here on Health 360 with Allen County Health Commissioner, Dr. Deborah McMahon. 260-452-1185 is the number to call, or you can post on Midday Matters, our Facebook page, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm.
WBOI's annual Jazz Fest comes Friday, April 12th at the Fillmore on Broadway. An intimate evening of jazz with five groups providing entertainment. Right now, tickets are $10 for students, $15 for NIPR members, $20 for the general public. Tickets available at our website. That's NIPR.FM. Tickets at the door will be $25, so get yours now at NIPR.FM for Jazz Fest, April 12th.
They say you are what you eat, so how much media do you consume every day? Are you gorging yourself on everything in sight, snacking between meals, sneaking the occasional tweet? I'm Audie Cornish. Look, if you've tried all the other news outlets but just aren't seeing results, check out the All Things Considered diet, weekdays. More news, less filler.
This afternoon at 4 here on WBOI.
On the next Fresh Air, Chris Hayes, the former host of the MSNBC morning show Up, talks with us about moving from weekends to weeknights with his new show, how he learned to deal with conflict on TV, and how he approaches the discussions he moderates.
Simmer, not boil, which is our ideal space for a conversation.
Join us this afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOY 89.1 FM. The time is 12:53. If you have a question or comment, feel free to write in at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. I'm Sarah DeLeo, joined in the studio this afternoon with Allen County Health Commissioner Dr. Deborah McMahon and my co-host Dr. Peter Rothman.
Dr. McMahon, how have these federal vaccination protocols been accepted by state governments, county boards of health, local school districts, and parents, of course, of the adolescent students? And what has transpired in the state of Indiana since these vaccines were introduced in 2006?
Well, as we've sort of been talking about the whole hour, there has been a lot of, I think, stigma about this particular vaccine. So I don't think the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices have been embraced as much as we would like, as perhaps other more traditional vaccines have been embraced by government, by, you know, in terms of mandating that for school entry, by schools, et cetera. So I would have to say that probably in Indiana, not as well as we'd like. I think when girls are 11 years old, they do get a letter from the school informing them about this disease and asking if the parents want any more information or if they want their children vaccinated, et cetera. But it's certainly not a mandate by any stretch.
But when this first came out in 2007, there was a mandate, but apparently there was so much discussion that the mandate was removed, and the only conclusion was that every child must bring home this document that describes HPV infection and the rationale of the vaccine.
Right. I think the tone in 2007, the vaccine was new. And again, I think, you know, 6 years is a lifetime in the age of the internet. I think there might be a different response if this issue were raised again. But I guess my bias is I think this is part with, particularly with the HPV vaccine, maybe even more than any other vaccine, it's part of a larger discussion between a child, a parent, and their physician. And I would really hope that doctors and parents would be willing to talk about this issue when you take your child in for that well child check, that school physical, that exam when they're 11 or 12. Because I think it really, in this day and age, you want the most important messaging about sexual health coming from physicians and parents, most importantly, because they're getting a lot of messages from the media. You want them to know what you think about this and what tools you want them to use for prevention. So I think it's, you know, I think that's something up for discussion, whether schools should mandate that. But I really would like to see more energy directed from physicians and from parents in taking this issue and making it part of, to me, that really important conversation, the beginning dialogue that you're going to have. It's an ongoing dialogue you need to have with your child, but that beginning dialogue you have with a child when they become a preteen.
So far in the United States, recent studies have shown that about 43% of parents have refused their children to have the vaccine, and only about 40% of doctors are actively talking about the vaccine with their patients.
And, you know, I think that's so disappointing to me because this is a medical issue. I mean, there's a social, certainly a social, emotional, spiritual, there's another aspect to the whole issue of sexuality, obviously, but this is still a medical issue, and doctors, I think, need to be prepared to have those conversations to sort of eliminate those myths that people may have. If we should be helping people have these conversations, they need to be able to, because again, the media has their own messages. We need to be partners with the parents in helping prepare these young people as they grow out to hear what they're going to hear, but to be able to filter it through what we've talked to them about. I think that's really important, that we need to start being more aggressive in our medical homes that we have for young people and approaching the parents and the young people with this vaccine.
We had just a couple quick questions I want to make sure we get to before the show ends in just about 2 minutes. A listener wanted to know if they're experiencing or if they've put themselves at risk for HPV. They feel like they may be in a situation mm-hmm. where that they were exposed to the virus. Can they go to just any gynecologist, or should they seek somebody else that is specialized in cervical cancer or HPV, or can any gynecologist provide them with the services that they'll need?
Oh, I think any gynecologist. And many of their family practice, if they have a primary care doctor, they may want to start with them as well. So I think any physician should be very well versed in this.
Mm-hmm. And we spoke a little bit about the anal pap smears. Mm-hmm. Is that something that is a routine for a woman during her gynecologist exam, or is that something that we have to request if that's something that you think that you need?
That would be something you'd have to request. Right now, it's more indicated for folks who have regular anal sex, especially those with HIV. That's a recommendation for them. For other folks, again, we always look for these guidelines as we learn more about diseases and how they present and the prevalence. Certain recommendations may change, but mm-hmm. as of now, that'd be something you'd request.
Okay.
A big takeaway from today's presentation is that we actually have a vaccine that can prevent cancer. And this is, I believe it is at this point, the only mm-hmm. one that we have of this type. And this is a marvelous development in our fight against cancer. So this should be taken advantage of by all our populations, starting at middle school age children.
Well said.
Thanks for joining us, Dr. McMahon. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 and HD Channel 1, streaming online at NIPR.FM. This is WBOY Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. We're coming up on 1 o'clock, and Fresh Air is up next.